They've given me a seatbelt here. I guess they think I'll fall over. I don't know. My name's Jerry Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober by the grace of God and these steps since January the 1st of 1973, for which I'm very grateful. I don't take a lot of credit for that. I just showed up and kept going. And some of the old timer says, if you just don't drink one day at a time and don't die, it happens to you sooner or later. I'm many things. I'm the adult spouse of an Al-Anon. Somebody has to do that. I'm a recovering lawyer. I haven't sent any bills, took any questions, appeared in any courts for about 8 or 9 years, and my recovery is going very well. So don't bother to ask me any questions, because you'll get no current information, I'll tell you that. I used to like to start off with lawyer jokes. But, as the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, John Rogers, said the other day, I found that lawyers don't laugh, and everybody else takes it seriously. So I quit telling them. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous not because I wanted to, but because I didn't know exactly what was wrong with me. I didn't think probably I was an alcoholic. I had difficulty with that word. It didn't come easily to me. When I tried to say it, it stuck in my throat. And I'd spend the whole meeting trying to think how I was going to say it when it came my turn, and it was hard for me. And then one day I remembered a story from my childhood that helped me understand what an alcoholic was. It made it easier for me. Had a dog named Patches. Patches was mostly a bulldog. He was a big fella, and he was a hero because he had killed a badger in a nose-to-nose fight. It had taken a couple hours for him to get that job done, but he had finally got it done. And he was celebrated throughout the community because most dogs can't whip badgers. The badger weighed one more pound than he did, so it was a pretty even fight. To give you a little insight into his personality, Patches would go up in the field where the carcass of that badger was, and for about a week he'd pick it up every day and just shake hell out of it, just to let the badger know if he was going to be reincarnated or anything like that. By God, he was still there and still willing to play. He was a dog of commitment. When he committed to something, he really did it. The day I'm going to tell you about, he was in our yard. He was laying there. He had no problems. He was a hero. He was well-fed. He was well-loved. He had no competition in the barnyard. He was just there and just king of the roost. And into our yard came the neighbor's boar hog. Big hog. Ugly hog. Long yellow tusk. Ambled into the yard, and Patches made a bulldog-like decision to get hold of the hog. And he went sailing into that hog and caught hold of him. The hog began to squeal. The dog was barking. My dad came out of the barn, and he got out there, and he was cussing and kicking hogs and dogs. I saw this fray going on. I went running into the middle of the damn thing. My mother saw her kid going into this hog and dog fray, and there was chaos in the barnyard. Everybody there had a problem. And they all knew the solution to the problem. Patches, turn loose the damned hog. Turn him loose. Well, he didn't turn him loose, but the hog got him up against the barn and drug him off and wheeled around and laid up on a shoulder and neck with one of those long tusks. And he was bleeding, and Dad caught him about that time and picked him up, and he was snapping and snarling, and Dad took him over to a water hydrant and ran cold water on him, and I was sent to the barn to get some pine tar to put on the, stop the blood. Things settled down. Things settled down. And we turned him loose, and he went right back and got hold of the damn hog again. And it was the same thing. There was barking and biting and cussing, kicking and screaming and wringing of hands. The hog knew the problem, the solution, and we knew the solution. Everybody knew the solution to the problem. Patches, turn loose the damned hog. Turn him loose. Well, he finally came off again. And this time my dad realized that Patches was not himself. Patches seems to be emotionally disturbed. Patches might have been considered crazy as hell, because that boar hog was a lot bigger than he was, and Patches needed restraint. What it was, we committed him. That's what we did. Some of you know about that. We chained him to the water hydrant, and Dad got in the pickup and drove the hog home, and I was given the job of counseling with Patches. I was one of the first Hogganine counselors in West Texas. And for sure I was the first Hogganine, because I was the only one around that way. And I talked to that dog. I talked to that dog in deep and penetrating ways. I asked him, you know, have you ever had a good day getting hold of hogs? What does your family think of it when you get a hold of hogs? Is there any peace and contentment in your life while you're getting hold of hogs? Do they taste good? What the hell do you get out of this thing except misery? And, you know, in about 2 hours, I had him laying down. He wasn't tugging at the chain anymore. He had his tongue out and that little silly smile on his face that bulldogs get. He was panting a little bit. He was laying down on the ground. So I went and got my dad, and I said, Patches has recovered. And Dad said, I'll go look at him, because I've had a fair amount of problems with him today. So he looked at him and he decided, sure, he looks okay. Patches looks like he's all right. We did the chain. He had to go 2 miles to find the hog the next time. Some of you can identify with one of the players in that I've said I was the first Hogganine, but a little later on I crossed the magic line. It turned out it wasn't hogs at all. Wasn't hogs at all. Wasn't hogs or badgers. He just caught one cattle truck. And that's all there was to Patches. A lot of people with our disease catch the cattle truck. We don't know we have it. We think it's our nature. We think it's just the way we are. We can't see the problem that exists in our lives, and I couldn't. I was raised on a farm out there in West Texas, and my father didn't drink after he got married. My mother never did drink. There wasn't anybody in that community that drank much that we knew about. It was virtually impossible for me to become an alcoholic from where I started. But I made it. I made it. And World War II came along. I was 10 years old, and all the men went off to war, and 10-year-old boys began to drive tractors and do men's work. That's what I did. Had a lot of responsibility thrust on me, which I took pretty well and handled pretty well, except from time to time, I'd get through with the responsibility, and I found what the cure for the load you had with responsibility was, a thing called irresponsibility. You wanted to drive a car real fast. You wanted to drink beer and run out from under the cans. You wanted to, you know, shoot insulators off telephone posts, do all those cute things that we did as country kids. And then when I finally found beer and alcohol, it just fit like a glove. I was in college at that point in time, and I don't know about you guys, I just love to drink. I could get positively excited about getting drunk a week from tonight. We're going to buy some booze. we were going to pool our money and put some gas in somebody's car, and there ain't no telling where in the hell we'll be the next morning. And there wasn't. Our first question usually was, where are we? Followed closely by, what did we do? And nobody knew for sure. We had to kind of piece it together, you know. And I was always the guy, though, from the very beginning, who said, let's do it again. Let's do it again, by God. And I was never going to give that up. I liked to drink. I liked what it did for me. I liked the people that did it. I liked the places we went. I liked the places they drank. I liked the whole, I didn't even mind the damned hangovers. They were just a price I had to pay. And the trouble I got into, oh, you know, I got into a fair amount of trouble right away. I had to convince the dean of the college that I was going to that while I wasn't on the band and had passed out on the band bus at a football game, the reason for that was I had become very sick while wandering around the parking lot looking for my car and finally found a place of refuge in the bus and lay down and just went to sleep. And nice man that he was, he bought into that crap, you know. And I went right on from there. I went to the Navy, drank some in the Navy, didn't get in any trouble. Drank when I was on shore, and they wouldn't let us drink on the ship. Went to law school, got married, went to law school, and had a kid. Didn't have enough money to drink there, and I couldn't pass those damn tests if I was drunk, so I drank between semesters. And then I got out and I got a job, a good job in a law firm in Dallas, and that was where it really began to take over. I just liked to drink. I drank every day. I could afford to drink a little bit. And it began to escalate on me. And I had some things that drove me. I had some ideas. You talk about our old ideas, how we have to give up some of them. I had to compete. I don't care what you were doing. If you're throwing washers at a crack, I had to get a washer and get out and with you and start throwing that washer, you know. And I as a lawyer, I started out in doing business litigation. Some of you, some guys here do that. And I couldn't do that because how in the hell are you going to win a deed? You can't win a deed. It's just a damn piece of paper or whatever, you know. So I got into trying lawsuits. And it fit like a glove. Except I don't like to lose. I really don't like to lose. And that losing, fear of losing, I didn't know it was. I thought I liked to win. But I can tell you after 40 years in the pit trying lawsuits, I can recall very few cases I ever won. I can recall all of those that I lost. And I can tell you the guy's name on the other side, the lawyer, the judge's name was, the plaintiff's name. I know the goddamn case, and I know why I lost that some way. I just know that. But that was my drive, and that drove me. And I always knew I was, you'd win them, and you'd win them, and you'd win them, and you'd think, well, sooner or later you're going to lose. Sooner or later you're going to lose. This may be the one you're going to lose. The client will fire you. He'll never hire you again. And that pressure that I put on myself internally built up. I had other pressures. I wanted to be a man. A man. I had hair on my legs, a little on my chest. I needed to be a man, by God. I was watching my dad one time, a little old boy, and Dad was working on a rusty bolt on a plow. And he gave up trying to take it off of the wrench, and he got a chisel and a hammer, and he was beating that bolt with that hammer and chisel. And he hit it a little crooked, and the chisel flew out of his hand and hit his knuckle. And he bled pretty good for that. And he stood up and he cussed pretty good. And it was okay to cuss if you're a man. I knew that. And he started back to work again, and I said, Daddy, that hurt? And he looked me just dead in the eye, and he said, hell no. A few days later, I was out playing with a hammer and chisel, practicing being a man. I hit my hand with a hammer. You know what? Hurts like a devil. It really does. I cried. And I was afraid to hit the hammer, hit the chisel anymore with the hammer. I flunked being a man on three counts right there in that one time. So I always had that feeling that I didn't quite, wasn't quite what I wanted to be, but I had to act like that's what I was. So I went on with my life living that kind of facade, trying to be something, trying to be what I thought you wanted me to be. I was one guy if I was talking to the Baptist preacher. I was another guy if I was talking to the bootlegger. But I always wanted to be what you wanted me to be. I had all of that stuff rolled up inside me, and I poured booze on it to give me a little relief, to make things a little better, to chemically alter the reality I thought I was living in. And I wasn't going to give that up. My drinking escalated over years. I got in a lot of trouble with my wife. I was not coming home. And so I'm that old responsibility since kicked in again, and I just quit going out with the boys. Just started staying home. Just brought my disease right in the house and shared it with the whole family. And I sat there in my green chair and drank whiskey, and the kids came up to me. You know, they got the brunt of it. They'd come up to me, and when I walked in the house that night, I was just, you know, happy and had a pretty good day, and I'd ask them how their schoolwork was, or did their ball team win a game, or whatever it was, you know, and they'd tell me about it, and I'd go sit down in my green chair and begin to have a few drinks, and the thoughts and the memories and all those things would come back to me, and they'd come up to me and start to tell me something else, and I'd snap at them and say, why do you think I'd be interested in that kind of crap? Just get the hell out of here and leave me alone. Jekyll and Hyde, I think they call that. I was not an easy person to live with. It was not easy to live with. My wife was we've been married 52 years now. She's a strong woman, I'll tell you that. She had sort of an abreaction to alcohol. I mean, she was hypersensitive about alcohol. It was kind of uncomfortable living with her there, you know. It was bad enough that I finally sent her to a psychiatrist and sadly she was sick enough to go. So she went and they talked, and he told her that she was a little too strict about drinking, and she did spend a little too much money, which was the other thing we talked a lot about. Then he said, well, why don't you send Jerry in and let me talk with him? And so I went to see the shrink, and we talked about football and any legal problems he might have. We didn't talk about me. I was not going to talk about me, and I left. And she'd keep going back, and finally she wrote a letter to the Texas Commission on Alcoholism, and ask them if they had anything that would help her determine whether her husband had a problem or not. And they sent her a damn test. Now, I'm good at taking tests. I did all right in law school. I know how to take a damn test. And I realized when I looked over that test, you read all the questions first. That way you can tell where they're trying to go. This test was obviously written by somebody that was a prohibitionist. He didn't want nobody to drink. So what you had to do, I drank. So what I had to do was just show that I was moderately in trouble. And they asked questions, dumb questions. Do you drink alone? Well, hell yes, nobody will drink with me. what's with this? And other things like that, inane type of questions. And I took the test, and I come out a heavy drinker, which was okay with me. I told the guys in the jail the other night when we were there, I had the image that I wanted to be a lover and a fighter and a wild horse rider and a right smart of a windmill hand too. And that's what I wanted to be, and I didn't mind drinking a little on the side. That's just fine. Well, that didn't satisfy her very long. Then she did something that was just, to this day, I marvel at it. She went to Al-Anon without asking me. She didn't discuss that problem with me. She didn't do anything. She just went to Al-Anon. And she didn't even tell me she was going. That was the sad thing. She'd been going quite a while when I found out. And I'll tell you, if they get them for a little while, they'll damn sure keep them. That's what happened to my mind. They brainwash them real quick. And they have them do funny things. They give them sponsors. Those sponsors are deadly creatures, I'll tell you. My wife's sponsor was just, I tell the story about, I was sitting at home alone with my dog, having a few drinks, and I got to thinking, you know, the only entity in this house that loves me is this dog. God, this is not fair. And my wife came in from one of those meetings. And I said, This dog here is the only thing in this house that loves me. And she said, just a minute, I'm going to call my sponsor. And she did. And she came back in a few minutes and she said, my sponsor says you're right. She says, we're going to fix that because we're going to buy you another dog. That's what you can expect from those people. They saved my life, is what they did. She kept going, and I kept trying to get her out of that thing. I threatened her. I did everything I could to run that woman off from going to Al-Anon meetings. I explained to her as carefully as a man can that she was going to ruin our lives. I gazed deeply into her eyes, sat her down, and said, now listen to me. Have you noticed that I'm the only one who brings any money to this house? She said, yeah, she knew that. I said, do you realize that if those lawyers in my firm downtown find out that my wife's been going to a public meeting for her alcoholic husband, that they'll kick me out of that law firm that day? And I won't take any clients with me. And we'll be standing on the streets of Dallas in the middle of the damn winter with our kids naked with no money. I made a pretty good pitch there. And she said, Jerry, I think I need to go. And I said, Billy, you must not go. She said, Jerry, I think I'm going to go. I said, Billy, I said something loving like, you know, Billy, if you go to another one of those damn meetings, I'll kill you just sure as hell. No. She went and I didn't kill her. But I kept trying to run her out of Al-Anon. And one night I came home and I'd planned, I don't know about you guys, but sometimes I plan fights. I plan to have a fight. I know we're going to have a fight when I get home. And I kind of figure out some questions I can ask her to get some information I'm going to need to win the fight. And I sneak up on her. And I went in this house this evening and I gave her a little kiss on the cheek and told her the dinner smelled good on the stove and said hello to the dog and the kids. And I turned and I said, Billy, you think I'm an alcoholic? And she said, I don't know whether you are or not. I said, well, that's damn funny. You've called me an alcoholic for years. And she said, yes, but I was wrong. It doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what your father or your mother thinks, your partners think, your friends think, your doctor thinks. It matters only what you think. If you don't think you have a problem with alcohol, you'll never do anything about it. Well, I'll tell you what, this conversation was not going the way I had planned it. And I was caught off guard, but I had a question. She seemed to know something, so I said, well, how would I find out if I was an alcoholic? The jaws of the Al-Anon trap closed just like that. She said, "Well, Jerry, one way you could determine it is if you quit drinking entirely. But I don't think you want to do that." I said, "No, you're right. I don't want to do that." She said, "The other way you can try it, there's a book called The Primer on Alcoholism that was written by a woman who was the first woman member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she says in that book, if you have a question about whether you're an alcoholic or not, you should drink 2 drinks a day, every day for 6 months. No more, no less, but every day. And if you can do that and never exceed that amount, at the end of 6 months, you'll know you're not an alcoholic." I said, "Wait a minute, let me get this on my mind. You've been trying to get me to quit drinking for years. Do I understand you want me to commit to drink 6 more months? And she said, "Yes." And I realized I was dealing with a seriously deranged woman. This conversation was going nowhere, and I got the hell away from it. I just said it's the dumbest test I ever heard and walked off, sat in my chair and drank for about 2 more weeks. And thought about that damn test. And I was really worried. I just made senior partner in my law firm. I did not want them to know my wife was going to meetings in which they discussed whether or not I was an alcoholic. I didn't want them to have even a hint that they'd ask me a couple of questions about the way I drank. And I didn't need any more fuel for that fire. I could tell you that for damn sure. I was sure they were going to fire me. And I realized that somebody was going to have to make a sacrifice for this damn family. And I guess that's going to have to be me. I guess I'm just going to have to take the damn test. I didn't tell anybody I'm going to take the damn test. I'm not that stupid. She watched me drink all the time. She knew exactly what I drank. What I planned to do was I just going to start taking the test. And she had noticed in a couple of months that I was doing that and doing just fine. And she'd get the hell out of that Al-Anon thing because she had to realize how a dangerous thing she was doing for the family. And then she quit and I could go back to my normal life. So I started the test. Well, I had to change the test a little. Two drinks really didn't do anything for me. But I had a pretty big glass, and I figure 3 drinks. I'd have 2 martinis, which consisted of Beef Eater's gin, maybe a little bit of vermouth. Not necessarily. Sometimes there was ice, and sometimes there wasn't. But I had 2 big Beef Eater gins. And then I would eat dinner. And then after dinner, I would have a brandy. In that same kind of glass with a little splash of soda for my digestion, which is what gentlemen did the world over after dinner. And she would not be able to say anything to me about drinking because this was reasonable. Unless she was completely a prohibitionist, this was a reasonable way to drink. I would not cause anybody any problems if I did this. So I started trying. And my recovery commenced on the first day I tried that. I didn't know I was recovering. I didn't know I was finding out I had a problem. But what I found out was I'd have about 2 of those drinks. And toward the end of the second one, I'd think, That's about all the martinis today. And then it would happen. It would happen. A thought would come in my head. And it would say, "What are you doing? What are you doing? Are you over 21? Are you a man? Are you going to let a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes tell you how to drink whiskey?" And the answer was, "Hell no." And I drank the bottle. Or some days I'd come in and I'd walk up to the bar and I think, "That's been a bad day today. Bad day today. Ain't going to be no damn test today. No test today, by God." Once in a while, I could forget the damn thing. Kind of on purpose. Kind of push it out of my mind. But that sponsor of my wife's, she had her doing things that were just unconscionable. She had her, when she woke up in the morning, the instant she awakened, the moment, the second she awakened, she was supposed to say out loud and with some feeling, "This is the day the Lord has made. I shall rejoice and be glad in it." Now, when you've had a quart of whiskey the night before, and you hear that, your head's throbbing, that boom, boom. Tongue's got that, you know, thick layer of something on there you could shave, you know. One of your eyes has been propped open for several hours, and you have what I call dry socket. And you're pretty sure you're not going to rejoice a hell of a lot that day. I'll just tell you that. And you think, why did I do that? Why did I drink that? I was going to just drink three drinks. What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? Good question. A guy that's had the kind of drive that I had, a guy that's had the kind of discipline that I had, that couldn't decide to drink three drinks a day and not drink anymore, that's a damn good question. And I gave that test a pretty fair shot. I tried it about a year and a half, and I never passed it once. On December 31, 1972, I had only one objective for the day. I needed to be sober so that we could go out to dinner with a couple of friends and have dinner on New Year's Eve and come back in the house. We're coming back to my house. I know why we're coming to my house, because I've already got out one time that month and it was hard to get me back in. And we're going to get me back in the house, and that they feel, I guess they take the car keys. I don't know what they're going to do. They're going to keep me in that house. Let me bring in the new year. That's what I think they're figuring. And I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. It's important that I do it. I need to do this. And I started that morning. I had decided I'd have just a little drink, just to kind of loosen up the day and watch the football games. Just a little sip. And I was pacing myself throughout the day, watching it very carefully. And I was in my green chair, and I woke up. And I looked out the window, and it was dark, pitch dark outside. And I looked over, and my wife was sitting in her chair, and she was in her robe reading the books, a little book. They read lots of little books, I've noticed. They leave them around for you, but I never read them. And I said, "Billy, shouldn't we be getting dressed to go to dinner?" And she said, "Oh, Jerry, don't you know what time it is?" It was a little after 10. I'd passed out at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I had no excuse. I wasn't mad at anybody. I wasn't celebrating anything. I had no reason in the world to drink the way I drank that day. I was sick of myself. I knew that she'd had to call those friends and tell them we couldn't go to dinner. And not only that, she had to call them and say, "You can't come over here either." Probably she'd be in Al-Anon like she was. She probably told him because Jerry's passed out in his chair. I don't know what she told him. But I was ashamed of myself. I was sick of myself. I was sick of what I was and what I wasn't. And I got up and I went to the bar and I mixed a big drink. I wanted oblivion and it knocked me out. God willing, that's the last drink I'll ever take. I got up on January the 1st, 1973, to the sorriest looking day I ever saw in my life. I sat on the edge of the bed that morning, hungover and sick, and Billy had already got up and gone to kitchen or somewhere. And I sat there on the edge of the bed and I thought, what am I going to do this year? It's a new year. What are you going to do this year that's going to make your life any better? What are your options? What options do you have to deal with this problem? And I couldn't think of any option except one, and that was to stop drinking. So I decided I would stop drinking. First time I'd ever had that thought in the many, many years that I had drank. And I showered, and I went in the kitchen, and I told Billy that I was sorry that I'd messed up the night before. She was not impressed with my little apology. She didn't hardly respond to me at all. And I said, I have decided I'm going to try to quit drinking. And that got her attention. She wheeled around, and she said, just a second. She ran over to the bookcase, and she happened to have a copy of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and the 24-hour day book. And she came running over to me with those books, and she said, you may find these helpful. Would you like for me to call somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous? And I threw the books against the wall and said, hell no. Hell no. You keep them damned AAs and everybody else the hell away from me. Keep the kids away from me, because this ain't going to be easy. This ain't going to be pretty. But by God, if anybody's going to do it, I'm going to do it. That's the way it's going to be. And she said something loving in Al-Anon, like, you got it, and walked off. And I had it. I didn't know I had had it, but I had had it. And I don't know how it was when you quit drinking. If you're doing something bad, when you stop it, shouldn't it get better? Didn't happen to me. I began to shake inside and out. I got quick. I couldn't sleep. I was not in the right place. I was never in the right place. If I was laying down, I ought to be standing up. If I'm standing up, I ought to be outside. If I'm outside, I ought to be inside sitting down. I'm just moving and grooving around, and I'm shaking, and I'm looking. And we go to the neighbors to watch the football game, and I don't see much of it, but I've looked all over the screen. And it doesn't get any better right away, I'll tell you that for damn sure. At the end of the second day, I caught her out of the kitchen, and I knew she'd left them damn books around there somewhere. So I decided I better go read them books and see what those AA and AA people do, whatever the hell they are. So I went in there, and I didn't have time. I'm sorry, I didn't have time to read the big book. Just didn't have time to do that. But I picked up that little 24-hour day book, and I opened it. With that keen alcoholic mind, I noticed there was a date on the top of every page. I turned to January 2nd, and it said, alcohol's ruined your life. And I said, yes, sir, yes. And it went on to tell me that this year we're going to give our drinking problem to God. I can't tell you how disappointed I was in that. How are you going to give something to somebody you can't find? I've been looking for God ever since I was a little old bitty kid. I wanted to find God. I wanted to see somebody walk on a little water or burning bush. I wanted something to big to happen to convince me that this was not some kind of con. I was always a skeptic, always cynical. I was born that way. And it never happened. I demanded God show himself to me, and he just didn't do it. And there I was in deep, deep trouble. And the book telling me I got to give my drinking problem to God is the only way I'm going to get out of this deal. And I don't know why I did what I did. But I threw that book out in the middle of the table and sat there in that chair and said, God, if you're there, I'm going to give you this drinking problem. And if you take it, I may do some more business with you. Maybe the best prayer I ever said. It was dead honest. I expressed myself exactly the way I felt. And I needed to drink just as bad after I said it as I did before. But I got through that day. And the next morning I got up and I knew something that I hadn't ever known before. I knew that my self-sufficiency wasn't going to handle this deal. I was going to have some help if I was going to quit this thing. It had me. If I didn't get some help that day, I was going to drink before the night was over. I needed some help with skin on it. I didn't need some spirit somewhere. I wanted somebody, some people. And the only people I knew was Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife had, you know, I knew about her. I couldn't call her much, though. She'd been there talking so damn long about me being a drunk that I couldn't. She'd poisoned the well there. I couldn't go there. So I called the central office, found it in the phone book. It sounded important, central office. And I got the most unsympathetic woman on the telephone I've ever heard in my life. I said, I'm having a little problem stopping drinking. And she said, how long you been sober? Well, this is my second day. You need to go to an AA meeting. I said, okay, fine. But you got to understand that I'm a pretty big time lawyer and I can't just go anywhere. I got to go to a secret place. She said, where do you want to go? What kind of group do you want to go to? And I said, well, I'd like to go to a group that's, you know, near a country club that has college graduates. And she said, we ain't got none of them. And she said, and I said, I can't go to a meeting every night. I can't. I'm a busy lawyer, too. And she said, well, what are you going to do at night? What have you been doing at night? I said, well, I've been drinking at night. She said, well, you're going to stop that, so you're going to have some free time, ain't you? So I said, give me a little quiet group. I want a quiet little group. It's got to be secret. So she gave me the town and country group. Sounded kind of woodsy, you know. I figured everybody drove station wagons that went there, you know, and I fit right in. And I went to that meeting. And hell, like, that was a revelation in itself. Their baby had a year and a half sobriety. The next guy had 5, and then they got serious. They had 10, 15, 20 years. And I didn't even believe that you could, I couldn't stay sober a week. How are you going to stay a year and a half or 20 years feeling the way I do? You can't do that. So they didn't have a lot of credibility with me. And we met once a week, whether they needed it or not. And she had told me I needed to go every day. But I didn't believe much about her. And about the third meeting that I went to there, an old boy came in from Heartview, North Dakota, treatment center. He had literature sticking out of every pocket. Ah, damn, he was hot. He'd been there 4 months. It was a 28-day program, and it had taken him 4 months to get out of there. Something about refusing to do a fourth step. I don't know what the hell it was, but I didn't know what that fourth step was anyway. I thought it's sort of like the Texas two-step or something. I didn't really know. Anyway, he knew more about alcoholism than anybody I'd ever heard in my life. I just soaked up everything he said. And most importantly, he looked like an alcoholic. He was still quick. And I was quick. You know, we'd sat there in that meeting and we'd look at each other and we knew we were dealing with the real McCoy. I followed him right out of that meeting and I got outside. His name was David. And I said, David. He said, yeah. I said, what do you think about this? what do you think about this AA thing? And he said, oh, you mean this one here? He said, this is not what we need. This is not what we need. These are people that have been sober for years and they're just kind of in a maintenance program or something. He said, we need to get in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to have to go to a meeting every night. We're going to have to get sponsors. We're going to have to do the steps. We're going to have to make coffee, whatever the hell good that did, but we're going to have to make coffee. And we're going to have to change the way we think or we're going to die drunk. And the miracle happened for me. I said, where are we going to go? He said, well, I heard about a little group that's just started way out in North Dallas on Alpha Road. I knew where Alpha Road was. It was way out of my territory. It had potential. He said, "Will you go with me tomorrow night?" And I said, "I'll think about it." So we parted. And I knew where it was. He gave me the address. And the next day I got in my car and I went out there and I cased it just like I was going to rob the damn place. First time I went by at about 55 miles an hour and just glanced at it. The second time I went by it, I pulled in. Didn't see anything the first time. I checked. It was in the second story. And there were windows facing the street. And I checked for surveillance cameras, spies, all that kind of stuff. It was passed all the tests. Nobody was there. It didn't seem like it. So I went in. It was over a 7-Eleven store. And I went in, bought me a Slurpee or whatever you get in a 7-Eleven store. Came back out. I checked it again to see what the activity was upstairs. It was quiet still. And then I noticed there was a driveway around the side of the building. So I backed my car out and drove around the back, and there it was. There were 6 parking places in the alley. I could climb the fire escape and go in the back door and go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the way you got me. I walked in. I didn't like you. I didn't want to drink coffee. I got hugged when I did not want to be hugged. I thought you were corny as hell. Everybody, some grown man stand up and say, "My name's Jerry." And everybody said, "Hi, Jerry." And God, I expect they'd come around and give me the grip in a few minutes, but they didn't give me the grip. They told the damnedest things about themselves. It was just pathetic. I mean, terrible, terrible things. Convulsions, arrests, imprisonment, getting sick, running off from their wives, all kinds of wild and crazy things. And every time they told one of these things, people just laughed like hell and and clapped. They had the most inappropriate sense of humor I'd ever run across in my life. Now, I told you I was competitive. And I hadn't been there a little bit, and I got to thinking, well, you know, I did a couple things that were kind of cute. I might tell them. And I did. And they said, "Looky here. Jerry's beginning to open up. He's beginning to be himself." And they told me, being yourself and living inside your own values is the greatest freedom you will ever experience. And they invited me into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a sponsor. I began to do the things they told me to do. I didn't believe. I did not believe. I had some kind of an idea that there must be some power greater than myself, a creative force or something for this universe. I couldn't get my head around anything else. But I had no concept of anything that power would come to me or a way I could engage that power. It just didn't make sense to me. I'd been to all kinds of churches. I'd talked to all ministers. I'd read books. I'd done everything I could trying to connect with what I thought that power might be, and I had had no luck. And I'd had no luck because it was all on my terms. I had made all the terms. And I realized that I was going to have to find a God as I understood him. I was going to have to find something to fill that hole in the program. And what it was for me, I got to watching people come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I saw people come in there that could not get sober. You could look at them and just tell, that man ain't going to make it. But by gosh, they did. They sobered up. They cleaned up. They became responsible people. Something was working in Alcoholics Anonymous. In meetings like this, once in a while, you could sort of feel something. You could sort of feel a power that was present, that had united all these people and drawn them all together in one mind. They thought different things. They had different ideas about this God, but they were all committed to the principle. And I decided that God for me was whatever works in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was supposed to be willing to add to that as I went along. I had a wonderful experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got in the middle of it, and I got in a group that grew from 50 to 600 in about 400 years. We 12-stepped anything that walked. My God, we were after them. We hunted drunks like you can't believe, and we worked on them. We made up meetings, and we really got after it. And I was right in the middle of that thing. I made close friends with some people. There's an old gal there that when I first came in, I could not stand. She was talked about darling, and she used word, she was just phony as she could be, I thought. And she grabbed me and hugged me, and I didn't want to hug her. I didn't want to be around her. One night she came up to me and she said, "Will you buy me some ice cream after dinner?" And I said, the meeting. And I said, she said, "I really need to talk to you." I thought, well, she's going to lean on me for some legal advice. That's what she's going to do. She's her ass is in trouble somewhere, and she's going to try to get some free legal advice out of me. She said, "Please, let's go with me to get some ice cream." So I said, okay, we'll go. I haven't got long, but we'll go. She took me to this ice cream place, told me what kind of ice cream to eat, where to sit. And then she flopped down and she looked at me and she said, "Some bitch, I've been looking at you." I thought, uh-oh. She said, "I think you're going to make it." She said, "I had 13 years in this program and I got drunk. And for 4 years, I've been out on the streets. I've got about 6 months now. And I really want to make it." And she said, I'm tough. I'm hard to get close to. And I need someone to watch me. Someone to tell me when I'm getting off the beam. Here's the way I act when I get off the beam. And I want you to watch me. And when I get off the beam, will you tell me?" I said, "You bet your ass. I'll tell you." She said, "Good, because I'm going to watch you too." And we added David, the guy that introduced me to that group, and the three of us worked the steps together. We processed our AA life together. One of us had a problem, we'd all check with our sponsors, and we'd come back and give the answer that each sponsor would give us, and we'd kind of shake out which we thought was the best answer and go that way. They really sponsored me more than my sponsor did. And we wound up, it was a new group at that time, and my gosh, at the end of the second year, I was sponsoring 25 people. And they were just growing. Somebody had to sponsor them. There was nobody else. The three of us just caught damn near every one of them that came in. It was more than we could possibly handle. And you know what happened sooner or later? Got too many and they began to fold away. But I learned a lot in those few years. My life changed. A man at the jail asked me last night if I had a spiritual experience. When would you have a spiritual experience? And I have had two or three of those that were really landmark moments in my life. One of them happened when I was maybe 3 or 4 months sober, and my wife and I were trying to put together a marriage. She and I had decided just before I got sober, that if we didn't get any better in 6 months, we'd get a divorce. Neither of us really wanted a divorce, but life was intolerable where we were living. And so we heard about this Baptist preacher who was giving a seminar out in East Texas, and we went out there. And there were only about 20 people there, 18 or 20 people there, about 8 or 10 couples, I guess. And after dinner that night, the preacher stood in the middle of a room, and it was a small room, and we were all sitting on the floor. There weren't any chairs. And he said, "Well, let's get this thing started. Let's go around the circle and let everybody tell you what God is doing in your life." Well, that's a testimonial. Baptists give testimonials. I was a Methodist. Methodists don't give testimonials. I ain't going to do this. And I would have got up and left, except I know this woman that's sitting beside me, my wife, she ain't going to leave. And I'm going to have to get up and kind of crawl across the floor to get out of that room. So I just decided, well, somebody will have sense enough to say, "No, thank you. I pass," or something. Well, they started around the room, and they were all civilians, not a member in the program. They were all civilians, and they had the wimpiest little problems that I had ever heard in my life. One of them couldn't drive the expressway without God. My God, I've driven the expressway drunker in Cooter Brown a million times. Another couldn't raise their family. Hell, I'd done a pretty good job with them. Couldn't keep a job. I'd kept a job all my life. I wasn't it. And I got thinking, you know, these people don't get it. They don't get it. I've been sober 3 months now. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic. I've been kept sober by something. I guess it's God. I guess it's God that's kept me sober. If I told these civilians about being an alcoholic and being sober for 3 months because God helped me, I'd blow the socks off these folks. That's what I'd do. They'd want to counsel with me right after this meeting, I can tell you that. I looked around that room real careful and I thought, I've never seen any of these people before and I'll probably never see anybody again. By gosh, I'll just tell them. So now I didn't hear anything for a while because I'm rehearsing my speech in my mind, you know. I don't hear anything. But it came, there was a couple next to me. The girl was sitting next to me and the old boy was sitting next to her. And he got up and he started trying to talk and it was pathetic. It was pathetic. It still is. He gave the most unmanly presentation that I'd ever seen in my life. He bawled. He blew his nose. He looked like he was a real man, you know. He has 6'4" and wearing rough clothes and had calluses on the back of his hands where they drug the ground. You know, you've seen that kind of guy. But he was a wimp that night, I'll tell you. And I wanted him to sit down. Sit down. Finally, he sat down. I never did get an idea what the hell he was talking about. And she got up. She got up and she was slender and she was pretty. And she had gray eyes like my mother. And she looked over the group and she said, I couldn't do it by myself. I just couldn't do it. God sustains me every day. And the most wonderful thing about God is that He's there for all of us equally. We all have the opportunity to form a relationship with Him. My children are just ages 2 and 3. And I won't be there to help them form that relationship. But they will have an opportunity to form a relationship with that power. We all do. And she went on to talk for a little bit, and I suddenly realized that I'm listening to a 32-year-old woman who's talking about how her husband can't possibly think about how he's going to live his life without her or raise those kids and how broken up he is. She's going to die in just a few months. She has cancer, an incurable disease. I have an incurable disease. Mine is called alcoholism. I've got a way to arrest mine. All I've got to do is do what you folks told me to do. And I had a big thought. A big thought. I've been feeling so sorry for myself. Self-pity was oozing out of me for having to quit drinking and go to meetings and all that kind of stuff. And this thought came in and pushed all that stuff out of my head. Said, ain't you got it tough, cowboy? Ain't you got it tough? If that little girl had your solution, she would say, take off both my legs. I'll give them both to you. Just give me that solution. I didn't make a speech that night. I don't know how I avoided making a speech. I don't know how I got out of that room. The next thing I really remember was I was out in the woods, tears stringing down my cheeks. And I made that old boy look like he's as tough as a boot. I was just bubbling and bawling. And I wasn't crying because I was feeling sorry for myself. I was crying because I had been given a way out. Gratitude. Deep, penetrating gratitude. I went from self-pity to that grateful shift in a moment. And that was one of my spiritual awakenings and spiritual experiences. I've never, ever felt sorry for myself for being an alcoholic since that day. And I don't feel very sorry for you either. We got a hell of a deal here. We really have. My life continued on. I got good relationships with my kids. My wife and I put that marriage back together. And as I told you, we've been married 52 years now. 53, I think it is. I don't cut that off the tape. We've got a good life. We've had a really good life. We've been wonderfully treated in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've been all over the world, AA meetings, and we've just had a ball. My mom was my great buddy. She was on that, there were three of us on that farm when I was a kid and World War II came along, and she was a skinny little Irishman, and she was a hard worker, and she helped me every way she could when I was that kid trying to do a man's work. And we were, both of us were trying to fight off my dad, who was a tough old bird, and she and I always were just big buddies. She got cancer before I got sober. They performed one operation, then they had a second one, and she called me and said, would I come up for that operation? And I said, well, yeah, I'd be glad to. And I didn't take a bottle with me because she didn't drink, and she didn't like me to drink, and so I just went up there to help her, and I wasn't going to drink. And they took her into surgery and operated, and the old family doctor was observing the surgery, and he came out in just a few minutes and walked over to my dad and I, and he said, boys, it ain't no good. I said, that cancer is everywhere. She'll be dead in a year. And it was like somebody flipped a switch on me. I just like a zombie. I turned around, walked out of that hospital, got in a car, went to the liquor store and bought a bottle. And for the next few days, I stayed around there drunk. I drank vodka and coffee and whatever I could, trying to cover it up. But my mother went through, she got out of recovery, and they sewed her up, and she knew it. Dad knew it. Everybody knew it, and they sent me home. I wasn't any good to anybody. Well, they gave her chemotherapy, and it worked real good. And she lived many more years. And when I was 5 years sober, she called me again, and she said, they found another lump in my stomach, and they're going to operate again, and I'd like for you to come up. I said, I'll be there. And I went up there, and we sat and talked, and it was easy. All the problems we'd ever had were laid to rest with her and my dad, and, you know, the conversation was smooth and easy. And she said, Jerry, I want you to get the family in here. I want to talk to them. So I rounded them up and brought them in there. And she said, folks, she said, I've had this cancer a long time, and I'm a lot weaker than I was when I got it. I don't know whether I'm going to make it this time or not. I'm going to try, but I don't know whether I can make it or not this time. It's going to be very, very hard on me, but it's going to be hard on you too. It's going to be a long pull for both of us. And while this is going on, she said, lean on Jerry. He'll be your strength. And it was. She lived a couple more weeks, and it was a horrible death. It just was just bad. She never really regained enough consciousness or awareness to converse with us that I could tell. And she was in lots of pain. And the last night of her life, I prayed that God would take her. And I told my dad the same thing, and he said, I did too. And she died that night, and my dad blew a big ulcer that night and had to be operated on, took most of his stomach out, so he couldn't go to the funeral. And I had the whole deal, and I handled that. And a couple weeks later, I thought, you know, that whole deal went on. That was as stressful a period as I've ever had in my life, and not one second during that period of time did I think about taking a drink. It never crossed my mind. The only difference between the first and the second time was the fact that I had processed my life in such a way that I'd made contact with a power that sustained me. That's what I believe happened. And I believe it will happen for you just as it did for me. It's done it for millions of people. And it was one of the most vital experiences of my life. Because of that, I have a great debt. I owe the world, and have owed the world for 30-some years, the debt of trying to repay what's been given to me. The only way I can do that is try to help other alcoholics. There's no shortage of them. They're all around us. Some of them smoke high-octane cigarettes and chew funny pills, but lots of them drink whiskey too. And we got the solution. We're the only group that's come down the pike that's really got the solution. A lot of people claim they got it, but I don't see the evidence of it. I really don't. Doctors and scientists have thought for many, many years that rolling a pill to us, some kind of pill would fix us. But thousands, millions of people have got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous without a pill. They did it because they got in right relationship with this power. It's here. It's in this room. It's in the meetings we go to. It's in the steps. It's a gift from a power greater than ourselves. And it's your job and my job to respond to that gift. We didn't deserve it. God knows we didn't deserve it. You had to pick a group of people that did not deserve what we got. You'd find be real hard for us to find it, you know. Lois Wilson was Bill Wilson's wife. She was one of the early people and a founder in Alcoholics Anonymous, really. She was dying. She was a great gal. She wrote a book, Lois Remembers. If you haven't read it, get it. It's she remembered more than Bill did for some strange reason. She was dying in the manager of the General Service Office in New York. Knew of that. She was up in New York in the East Coast there dying, and she was in intensive care. But you could go, they could let one or two people go in a day to see her, and he made an appointment, went out to see her. And he went to see her because he wanted to thank her. He knew she wasn't going to come out of there. And he went to thank her for what she'd done for Alcoholics Anonymous. And he talked to her a little while and told her what was going on in the world. And then he said, Lois, I came here today because I wanted to tell you how much, on behalf of Alcoholics Anonymous, how much we appreciated what you've done for our fellowship. And you saved our lives. And she had a little pencil and paper. And she wrote on the paper, not me, God. And handed it to him. And he said, well, okay, you got me, Lois. Of course you're right. Of course it was God. But you were his messenger. And she picked up her pad again and she wrote, and so are you. And so are you. Each of you. And the way you discharge that responsibility is the way you're going to feel good about yourself and the joy and happiness you're going to have in your life. I don't know of anything that's added to my life, anything like Alcoholics Anonymous has. You could say my children, my family, sure, but I wouldn't have had them. I wouldn't have had them if I hadn't had Alcoholics Anonymous. Every good thing that I wound up in my life came from and through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a wonderful way to go. Ain't we got it tough? Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.